Struggling to keep track of your story and world? Archivos is for you. More intuitive than a wiki, more extensible than Scrivener, Archivos builds your story Bible into your personal, always-on tactical display. Graphical relationship charting, continuity tools, this thing has it all, with bonus options for fan engagement and real-time collaboration. Archivos. Story world management done right. www.archivos.digital. That's www.archivos.digital. Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer, author of nearly 30 books, more than 30 short stories, and numerous articles and scripts and essays, coming to you from up in the crow's nest with my spyglass on this daily voyage through the dicey waters of business, craft, learning, and art in the writing life.
Welcome to The Questions, episode 875.
Today we hear from Roland, who says,
I really enjoyed your talks with Gail about the heroine's journey. I've listened to her book twice and ordered the paperback. Her book and your podcast discussions really helped me with the series I'm working on now. It never really fit the hero's journey, and now I know why. Plus, all the things that I had already planned for my series kept coming up, and I felt like I was checking them off as you all talked. Found family, teamwork, sacrificing for friends and the greater good. In her book, she talks about Battlestar Galactica, Twilight, and other long works, how they are heroines' journeys, but each was long enough to have smaller journeys within. I'd love to not make the mistakes they made. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on keeping up with the long-term arcs while making each short-term arc satisfying and true to the characters.
Well, one of the things is that the short-term arcs need to illuminate and give meaning to the longer-term arcs. God, it's a great question, but it's very vague, and it's hard to get my teeth into.
We could talk about some of the problems that those series had. Actually, we can't really about the Twilight.
Twilight, I failed out of that after book one.
I didn't start with that, but a succinct answer to it is actually have a plan.
Or at least don't release until you're done.
One of the problems with that Battlestar Galactica and Lost had that Babylon 5 did not was that their showrunners did not know where they were ending up. They had a start, a really good start. They had a few ideas. They carried them through, and then they kind of got lost because they didn't know where they were ending.
Well, yes, but I think... Oh, God, I'm going to get burned at the stake for this. deeper than that, because you can write amazingly complex arcs through one and done. You can train yourself to do that, and a lot of people do, and do it very, very well, and have. Like, for example, Charles Dickens. All of his stuff was serials. When the first episode published in the newspaper, the last was not done, and yet he winds up having written several towering works in the English language. The problem is that most writers do not know how story works. And by most, I mean even people like J.J. Abrams and Ronald D. Moore. They're working from, wouldn't this be cool? Giveaway that you're running down a blind alley is, if your story formulation is driven by, wouldn't this be cool? We talked about this actually obliquely in the commentary we recorded last night. Those of you who are supporters will have discovered the commentary in your feeds by now. And those of you who aren't, it might be worth joining up just for this one. We did the Ethan Hawke film Predestination, which has one of the tightest scripts ever written. It's really fantastic, and it's adapted from a well-known short story that we read right before we did the commentary, so we also commented on the adaptation process.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the problems that people like Moore and Abrams and Whedon and a lot of the other really hip screenwriters that just can't seem to tell a really good, tight story have is that they're driven by the rule of cool. It's what happens when people who have a fanish mentality go on to create what's basically fan fiction, but not set in anyone else's universe. Like I said, I'm going to get fucking crucified for this. But
I'm gonna link to an article on that covers a similar train of thought.
Okay.
On the rule of cool.
Cool. One of the giveaways for something that's written using the rule of cool is that it's like kitchen sink storytelling. It runs on the novelty engine. You get a cool idea, and it's so great, and it takes you to a certain point in the story, and then everything seems to run out of steam, and so you grab for another cool idea and try to make them work together so that you can extend the sequence of events. That's the opposite of what you need to tell a good story. To tell a good story, you literally need one idea. Now, the idea itself is going to be a hybrid of other ideas that have come together. You need one idea, and you maybe a couple of supporting ideas that work in such a way together to create the inevitability of one idea.
Mm-hmm.
And you take the one idea, and that's your guiding light all the way down. When you run into a wall, it's not because you ran out of idea. It's because you took the wrong turn at Albuquerque. Or you haven't drilled down enough to find out what other fertile material is in the idea.
Yes.
Occasionally, it may mean you don't have a really great idea. But frankly, even some really crap ideas can produce some amazing books if you're willing to drill down enough and really come to grips with what it might mean if that thing were true in your story world.
Yeah.
True Blood went off the rails like this, too. And I enjoyed it all the way to the end, even though it completely fell apart and got stupid.
It sort of redeemed itself at the last season,
It managed to keep that central romantic thread pertinent enough that the fact that none of the rest of it worked was enough to hold my interest. But you start out, there's this world where vampires have always been undercover, and now there's been synthetic blood that has been invented, and so vampires are outing themselves so they can join legitimate society and be socially respectable. They're coming out of the coffin.
Mm-hmm.
All right, obviously a metaphor for gay people coming out of the closet. And coming from Alan J. Ball, that shouldn't be a surprise, because Alan J. Ball is very, very gay. But as a premise, metaphorical baggage aside, it's actually pretty interesting. It has fantastic implications for the potential history of the world. What are the shadowy things that vampires have been doing in the background to move world history, perhaps to instigate wars so that there will be chaos during which they can feed and feast and convert? There's all sorts of amazing ideas that are implicit in that one little premise. And they started kind of going that direction. And then they threw in shapeshifters, and werewolves, and
fairies,
and werepanthers, and all sort and half vampires and vampire fairy hybrids and all sorts of other shit that were all cool ideas on their own. Oh, and maenads and all just
goddesses.
And goddesses. I started calling it kitchen sink urban fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
Because they just throw everything at you but the kitchen sink in order to keep your interest, because they're depending on the rule of cool. Instead of building depth into the storytelling in such a way that makes you need to come back. If you're doing a long arc, say for example like I'm doing over the Lantham books, it's 10 novels, one arc, each one standalone enough that you can read it by itself, but if you read them all together, you come up with something really, really interesting. Now, I knew at the beginning where the end point was, more or less. And the reason I knew is it's implied
in the first book.
I wasn't actually intending to make this an arc based around the story that was told in the first book, but by the end of the first book, it was implicit, and it was a big deal, and so I did. And so every book since has its own hero's or heroine's journey, or sometimes a hybrid of the two, but they put pieces in place that I'll need to have in place for the final story. Now, I haven't written the final story yet. It's the next one I've got to write. And so I don't actually know how it's going to go because I don't have it planned out. I've got the first scene and I know two or three possible endings that could all work. But I haven't picked them and I'm not going to until I'm in the book.
And by ending, you mean endings for the main characters and endings for the arc and the mystery. Mm-hmm. And those are There's three separate endings.
Endings for this book, for this coming book, endings for each of the characters, and endings for the arc.
Yeah.
Over that long of a series, you have to have character growth, or you have to have a succession of cool premises with no character growth. And you can't really be switching back and forth, because the audiences that are in there for the cool premises and the adventure, not terribly interested in character growth. And the audiences that are in there for character growth, if you're giving them the cool premises and adventure, they may feel like it's a bit light. So you often just have to pick one or the other. Some people can combine them well. I don't know if I could. I haven't had the guts to try yet. But each of the journeys along the way is a part of your character or the world or whatever it is, whatever the main character of the series is, and it doesn't have to be a person. It could be a society, it could be a world, it could be a historical sequence, it could be a religion, it could be an institution, whatever it is. Each one of the arcs is a part of the becoming. Mm-hmm. So that when you get to the end, what you want is the simultaneous feeling of surprise and inevitability. It could not have gone anywhere but here.
You want that kind of reaction instead of coming to the end and going, where the hell did that come from?
Right. And you want it to be surprising because people are delighted by surprise. But you want it to be surprising in the experience and obvious in retrospect. One of the problems that the Rule of Cool does, and this is what killed, or at least mortally wounded, Battlestar Galactica and Lost, which... Lost had a great finale. It just didn't work very well with the rest of the series unless you knew a particular set of myths from Aztec mythology and you could fill in the gaps yourself, which is not really good for the general audience. And it was obvious that they kind of pulled it out of their ass in the last season and started working everything around to this ending. And Battlestar Galactica, they went off the rails in season 3. And the reason was they kept going, oh, we'll just bring this cool thing in. And they come out with this pile of stuff that all feels cool together. But when you try to make sense of it, you can't come up with anything that connects it all in a way that's satisfying. The great secret to meaning is that meaning is deeply tied to sense-making. If you cannot make sense of something, it will be meaningless to the readers. If you're doing absurdism, where the actual meaning is the meaninglessness, Camus, Beckett, etc., that can work. But there's a very, very wide gulf between the absurdists and the hacks who fall down on the job because they're having too much fun to actually consider their craft.
Although if you really want to lean into stuff that just explores interesting ideas, sketch comedy needs some reinvigoration. Comedies and comics and that sort of thing are a great way to explore this cool random idea, because you can have all the cool things happening and not have to connect them together.
But to circle back around,
yes,
all of this is to say that the people who are able to write without planning everything out can do it because they know how stories work. And they don't just know how stories work on a semi-formal level. They know it deep in their bones. They are the kind of people that can tell a story sitting in a barbershop chair. And it's because they swap stories verbally, they swap jokes verbally, and most of the great masters and mistresses of fiction through the centuries have a grounding in the classics. And it is very, very difficult to commit the kinds of errors that you see in Battlestar Galactica and Lost if you have a solid grounding in the classics.
Mm-hmm.
Because antiquated though they be, literally, they're mm-hmm. antiques, the reason that they last is that they have discovered something about how the human mind makes meaning, and they've projected it into structures that mirror the way that human life works at a baseline biological level. The hero's journey, the heroine's journey, the civilizational epic, as opposed to the Icelandic sagas types of epics, which are hero's journeys. Oh, and the Eternal Return, which is the Eternal Return and the Koan. These are story forms and formulae that have been discovered and rediscovered. And I'm deliberately not saying invented. They were discovered and rediscovered in various cultures around the world and form collectively the literary traditions that the great civilizations of the planet are based on. All of the same elements that are present in Western storytelling are present in Eastern storytelling. The way they're combined and the expectations for how they should be combined are a little bit different, which is why anime feels so strange and yet so familiar, because it's a hybridization,
mm-hmm.
quite frequently a hybridization, of Japanese and American story forms, which are themselves modern-day manifestations of the Eastern and the Western literary traditions. There are also Native American literary traditions and African literary traditions that are all broadly, in a regional sense, broadly similar. Each nation and tribe has their own particularized tradition, just like each nation and tribe in Europe and India and China and the islands in the South China Sea all have their own particularized forms. But there is a broad categorical sweep that a broad regional similarity that kind of makes them part of the same class.
Mm.
But all of them share with all of the others the common elements of story and how they work. Story is discovered, not invented. And the over-pursuit of novelty through the rule of cool or any analogous type of thing is basically an attempt to invent story. And you can't do that. Human minds work a certain way. Underneath all of the culture, we find meaning in a particular narrow set of fashions. And understanding classical storytelling, not like analyzing it, reading it, memorizing the shorter ones, getting it down into your bones so that you can see story wherever you go. That's what Dickens did. That's what Mary Shelley did. That's what Ursula Le Guin did. That's what Poe did. That's what they all did, and that's why the stories do not go off the rails the way so much modern storytelling does. Because the people who are doing modern storytelling, most of them haven't even heard of the classics. And those that have certainly haven't read them, and those that have read them critically, from a point of view of deconstructing them and analyzing the cultural biases inherent in these old stories. They do not read them simply to read them. And because of that, they don't learn story. They learn about stories. And there is a very important qualitative difference. Just like you can know all about music and not be able to riff on a beat, you can know all about story and not be able to tell one to save your life. So learn story. Don't learn about it. Learn it. Make it part of you. Read the classics Don't study them. Listen to them in audiobook form. If I find that, now you all know about my reading difficulties and whatnot, but a lot of these older stories were actually composed to be orally presented, and so you actually get more out of them if you listen to them, especially the epic poetry and Shakespeare.
Oh God, if you hate Shakespeare, chances are you hate it because you had to read it as if it were a book in your literature classes in high school. It is meant to be performed. You would do better to read it aloud to yourself and attempt to perform it, or watch a
theater production or a relatively unexpurgated film adaptation.
Yeah.
And the same is true of Sophocles and... not Apuleius. Apuleius actually wrote novels. Whoever it was wrote The Frogs, Euripides. These are theater productions. They're meant to be seen and heard. And the epic poems like the Odyssey and the Iliad and the Homeric hymns, those are meant to be heard. Just like Beowulf is meant to be heard. And actually, the Silmarillion was deliberately written to be heard. In the King James Bible also was deliberately written to be heard and not read.
Great story about the Silmarillion. Dan loves Tolkien. He couldn't stand the Silmarillion until I picked up an audiobook of it that was...
read by Martin Shaw. Did such a wonderful job.
It was a BBC production, I think.
No, he's a frequent BBC actor, but it was Simon & Schuster, I think, or HarperCollins.
And that brought a new dimension to it, and he was able to get it on a visceral level. And that really, I kind of remember that changing your attitude about a lot of things. The realization that made such a difference in how you received the story.
Yep, and it allowed me to see a lot more of a lot of other different stories because it connected my musical ear to my reading eyes. Mm-hmm. And also changed the way I write. That was the point at which I started writing like a musician instead of like an essayist. So, yeah, all important stuff. And actually, to this end, your question, Roland, has given me an idea. There's going to be a special episode tomorrow, and at least one a week, maybe two a week for an indefinite period going forward, where I read public domain poetry. Now, unfortunately, it has to be public domain, so I won't be able to get some more recent stuff, which is really good. So there's not going to be any Robert Frost. But
Robert Frost isn't in public domain yet?
1927.
Really?
Yeah. Frost was the poet laureate under the Kennedy administration. He didn't die until the 70s. It's going to be 70 years after his death.
Oh, bugger.
But stuff from before 1927, and I'll be reading poems as they're intended to be read, and I'll talk a little bit more about the why. This question was part of it, but it was also brewing in my mind for other reasons. So join me tomorrow and find out. We'll see ya.
The Everyday Novelist is written by J. Daniel Sawyer and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and Kitty Nakian and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. The text is copyright 2019 J. Daniel Sawyer and the production is copyright 2019 Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners. Join the conversation. Submit a question, leave a comment, or a creative death threat. Or find me at jdsawyeronminds.com or hit me at feedback@jdsawyer.net. We can't do it without you.